I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Sanjay from Nottingham, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, Dane, do you believe in God? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Sanjay from Nottingham's question, Dane, do you believe in God? Sanjay, this bit section of the show is only supposed to last a couple of minutes, so...
But that's not as a bad question. He is living exactly up to what we say on the tin of this podcast. So, Sanjay, thank you for the question. I think we're also going to revisit this on our next live recording of the podcast. Nice. Look out for that, guys. Yeah. Date to be confirmed. But I would say, to keep a concise answer, I don't like to use the word believe. I know there is a God, and I say God is love. So that's the most concise answer I can give. I know there is a God, and God is love. When you consider how love works and how it is described and articulated within our culture, that would be the closest way to describing God as a phenomenon too. Oh, well. As opposed to a guy in a white tunic with a big old dick the size of a planet, which is just weird.
Wrote a really awkward book.
I wrote a really awkward book, which never requires any updates, and apparently... Like, despite the fact that he can create an entire universe and needs money.
If they started updating the Bible like they update my iPhone, it would never fucking end, would it?
Well, how, you know what? But it's funny you say that, because if you were to ask me on a large scale about spirituality and religion, I think the folly of religion is that it doesn't work like science enough, and science doesn't work religiously enough, in that, you know, religion should, like science, have theories that they regularly test in order to change when they come to a different conclusion, and change the conclusions of the truths they believe to be within religious doctrine. And I think science should have a idea of divinity and understand, even though they can do certain things, doesn't mean they always should.
Interesting.
Like fracking.
Well, Sanjay, I hope that answers your question. And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dave?
Absolutely, Howard. As you know, we like to answer questions, and we like to take a walk through the human mind, but we don't have a God complex, so to speak. But we answer all the questions, and if you do like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts, or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of our questions and answers from all of our very, very special guests. With that being said, on today's show, our guest is a stand-up comedian, actress, and writer. She's been a professional stand-up comedian since 2004, with her debut show, Beth Becomes Her, detailing her transgender story. It was nominated for Best Debut at the Leicester Comedy Festival. In 2016, she was cast as Helen in Russell T. Davies' Channel 4 show, Cucumber, Banana and Tofu, where she was the first transgender actress to play a leading role. In 2020, Beth won the joe.co.uk Comedy Award. If you don't know by now, get to know, it's the best bedroom I've ever seen on this podcast today. Please welcome to the show, Miss Bethany Black.
Oh, thank you, Dane. Hi, Howard.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
Let's just describe the bedroom to the listeners. We're talking about some serious Hulk posters and a lot of other... There's a Catwoman poster. There's some good geeky memorabilia going on, right?
Yeah, there is. It's my... Yeah, it's essentially what you're seeing right now is my Twitch background, which is I've got a poster of lots of Silver Age Marvel Comics covers. There's a little Wolverine poster that's sort of just off camera. I've got a little TARDIS in the back from when I was in Doctor Who.
And I can also see the Super Mario cube as well.
Yeah, Super Mario coin cube in the background. Nice. And I'm such a nerd.
Yeah.
And I'm not even going to apologize for that anymore. I've just decided to lean into it.
It's a good...
The nerds have won. That's the revenge of the nerds was a complete success, and the nerds have won. Listen, I think the Avengers is one of the highest grossing films of all time, Avengers Endgame, right?
Yeah.
Which means the nerds went to war and we won.
And, and let me tell you something. I my wife is a massive geek, as I've said many times on this podcast, and we have started watching all of the Marvel films in order that they were released. And blimey, just because you've got the Marvel stuff on the walls, you realise that those films are superb and actually better consumed in the medium of television, because we're not watching each film like one a night or anything. We're watching it over a few nights. Amazing. They're absolutely amazing.
It's the thing that really annoys me at the moment in the way that people review those review Marvel stuff is that they seem to think that they seem to have forgotten that the Marvel comics have existed for decades and have worked in the exact way that the films and TV series are now working.
Exactly.
And they're going, oh, people can't remember this. And what's going to happen? Like, if you haven't seen all of those things, you can't just jump in. But the thing is, you can. And they make it work in a way that means that it does work much better when it's consumed as a whole. But you can just go and watch the bits of it that you're interested in.
It works on a number of levels, like comics do as well, man. You're seeing like a lot of action, like, you know, very good script and like an in-depth script and funny, witty. But there's also like a longer narrative as well. So you're willing to indulge it, just like with comic books and stuff as well. So, you know, I think, you know, a lot of the detractors of something like the Marvel Cinematic Universe are people that have been weaned on reality TV for a long time, where most of the archetypes and the characters and the protagonists they meet are so insignificant that you have to write their name under them when they appear on screen, just to remind people of who they are. There's a reason why when you watch TOWIE and like, you know, Made in Chelsea, they have to keep reminding you of the names of the people involved, because they know the things that are taking place here don't really resonate with people. So they have to remind you.
They are. I mean, I've currently been writing a piece about Marvel Cinema, because I've been writing for a couple of film magazines recently, and I've been writing a thing about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and how it's so much of it is about our individual and collective responses to trauma. Avengers Assemble is essentially like the big, it's American art, experiencing and sharing what it kind of felt like to be in America at the time of 9/11. And that's kind of what it feels like. It's, and you know, all through sort of like the history of culture, we've always had like horrific things happen and then having to try and comprehend them. It's like Theodor Adorno, the German philosopher, who was sort of saying that trying to write poetry after the Holocaust is just a horrific thing to try and do, because when you've seen such horror, how do you even try and express that in any way that you can go and without diminishing it somewhat?
And I think absolutely
that's so much of what's going on, and so much of our culture is about how we've reacted to the horrible things that have happened to us in a way of trying to make sense of it, which is why I absolutely adore film and television.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's that really, you know, film and television really are the mediums by which human beings realize their humanity. Like, that's the whole endeavor with the creative industry, or just, I should say, creative pursuits rather than the industry, is that the idea is that I'm taking a concept or an experience and trying to make that tangible and perceivable to other human beings, because we're a social species. That's how we're able to imprint. So, you know, like, there's obviously the appeal of these films, particularly given the current zeitgeist, where, you know, there is obviously a yearning for human beings at large to find more exceptional people able to lead the rest of us into, you know, more prosperous or utopian times.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just becoming a lot more sensitive and aware of a lot of the political intrigues.
Yeah, because so many of those stories, they were immigrant stories. That's how they started. Many of them were, they were the Jewish immigrant experience of arriving in the US around about the time that the Nazis were rising in Germany.
Yeah.
And the responses to that and the ability to take power back. And so some of the stuff from around that time, incredibly problematic when you look at it now, but from where it's gone, from where it started to where it's got to, there's been such a good, well-developed evolution with those, each of those steps.
Comics is, one of the biggest boons of comics has always been escapism. And I think anybody who's from a historically oppressed group, like having the ability to escape and project onto archetypes, which, you know, provide that avenue of escapism and fantasy, you know, that's always going to have infinite importance to human beings as long as we are anchored to this mortal coil. So,
Well, it's probably time for a question, Dane, as the format of this show dictates. I mean, that was a brilliant, that was almost like a question in the preamble, Dane. It never usually gets that deep, does it? But there you go. But no, it's time for a question, I believe.
Absolutely. And Bethany, as our very esteemed guest, we invite you to ask the first question. Any question you would like, which we will discuss for 15 minutes or some change. Then Howard will ask his question and we'll do the same. Then lather, rinse, repeat. I'd like to ask you a question, which we discuss for 15 minutes or so. And then we can have our listeners find out where they can find about all your good works and presence throughout the internet and otherwise. And then we all go on to lead wonderful lives and we all sit down and we wait for the next episode of The Winter Soldier and the Falcon. So, does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, I can't wait.
Sounds
like a good plan.
So, the floor is yours to ask the first question.
Yeah, so I suppose my question is, where do you find peace? Where do you find tranquility? Where are you most feeling at one with the universe around you?
What inspired this question for you, Beth? A great question, by the way.
It's the thing that I always want to know about people, like, because so much of our lives today, so much of the world that we sort of spend time in, especially if you're like me, because I'm autistic and I have ADHD and I really struggle with being out and about and amongst people. And I found social media to be a really, really good way for me to have, for me to build social relationships. Partly because it doesn't there's very little other distractions and I can be in control of the interactions that I have. And so much of that, it gets such a bad press because so many people get so upset and so angry and use it for fighting and arguing and just being horrible to each other without ever thinking of the consequences. And it, so as a result of that, a lot of what I see of other people comes filtered through that lens. And so what I always want to know is when I meet people and I talk to people is, where are they? Where are they when they are not trying to be someone for other people? Who are they when they're being themselves? Where is it that they find peace?
It's fascinating. Dane, I think you've got some very clear answers. My answers are very quick, actually, for this.
How would you, for you first?
Yeah,
you first.
Well, mine are really quick because I am not a peaceful guy. I am a man not at ease with the world naturally, and often I wouldn't say I'm a restful soul. Sometimes I will completely shut off and just. But so for me, I've only got kind of two things that provide me with great peace. I'll just be honest. It's probably an empty house with I've probably smoked a joint, and which is a rare occurrence for me nowadays. Just to flag up to any professional.
unless you're in the business of helping me and Howard raising awareness for your amazing CBD products, then we are happy to do so.
I've got nothing against anyone who smokes weed every day. I just couldn't exist if I did. So I very rarely. So that's why the rarity of a small joint, some form of pizza and sugary drink, and an ice cream, and a movie or a football match, and in that zone, that trifecta of weed, sugar, and visual entertainment, you will find me. At peace. However, recently I've got a new one, actually, Bethany, which is in the madness of having a child, right, you do not find peace. It definitely isn't a peaceful experience. He woke up and he was up from 3 till 5 the other night. I don't know if anyone's ever screamed at you from 3 till 5 in the morning because their teeth hurt, but let me tell you, it's not peaceful.
Yeah, my girlfriend all the time. Wisdom teeth coming through.
But let me tell you, there are moments with this boy now where I look at him and it lasts maybe like 20, 30 seconds, but he is at peace. He's happy in the world and doesn't need me to do anything, right? And it is just like witnessing, Dane was talking about God and love, and it's just like witnessing existence, like in some kind of pure form. So those are my two. Those are my two.
Exactly what it is, Howard. Mm. Howard, like I said, God is love. Exactly what it is you are marveling and loving your creation.
Mm.
As God in religious texts described, is that, you know, that's someone loving your creation, but by the same token, not being able to control everything they do because they have free will. So, but we'll come back to that conversation. But, you know, it's a really good question in terms of peace. Because I have been told, and I'm sure I have. I don't think I'm necessarily on the spectrum, but I have traits with like attention deficit and the like and stuff as well. And I think we live in a very highly stimulated world nowadays anyway, where, you know, our lives are a bombardment of colors and hues and tones and sounds. And so having peace for anybody can be very difficult. It can be very difficult. So I guess I kind of can retroactively look back at what disrupts my peace. Well, let me know what gives me peace. So for one thing, I guess when you said about, how do you, when you're not trying to be something for everybody else, in a weird way, that I do find it quite peaceful. And that's probably because of the fact that I spent a lot of time being existentially frustrated about my life and the condition it was in. So when I was having to work a 9-to-5 in the industry I wasn't too interested in a place where I wasn't really, there was no idea of having a career, I found myself being a lot more troubled. Whereas I guess now that I'm able to work within the industry and have my dream job, that in itself does give me a large element of peace where I suppose you think about most human beings and their complexes or their neuroses, a lot of them will tend to revolve around their work and their career and their livelihood. So having the fortune of being able to work and do something I enjoy does give me an immense amount of peace. And that in turn, I can project positive whereby it means I'm never threatened by, you know, new entrants into the market or, you know, new comedians or people sharing stuff because I'm happy where I am and I'm able to do something I never thought I'd be able to do. So you can never feel threatened about it. The other thing I'd say about...
I think I'm just going to cut that bit out, Dane, and just send it to your manager so they have it on record for all time. Dane Baptiste finds peace in comedy is a lovely sentence.
Totally relate to that. I totally relate to that. Kay Kurt, who was mentioned earlier, I know has been on the show, he has absolutely no idea, but he was absolutely instructive in helping me reach a point where I was completely at peace with my place in stand-up. Because Kay, if you've met him and spent time with him, he's so focused and he's like laser focused and knows what he wants and is prepared to go and get it. And I really admire him. And it reminded me of what I was like when I first started out before I got so many knocks and couldn't quite do that. And I remember doing a gig with him and just talking to him about this and coming away from it going, I don't feel like I need that anymore. And that was freedom. That just felt like freedom in that moment. I was like, right, yeah, I'm not. And it's that, not being threatened by other people because there's not like a finite amount of success that we all have, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And also what success means to different people. And you can't do everything because like the physicality of that would involve you spreading yourself quite thin. But it kind of brings on to another point where like before I started doing comedy, I wanted to make sure I put myself in best stead to perform the position as best as possible. When I was younger, like years younger, like a friend of mine, he was obsessed with ninjas. They used to have like loads of books at his dad's house and we used to read books. And one of the mottos of the ninja is nothing is to be feared, only to be understood. Yeah. And so I always made it a point or principle that if there was any kind of, ideology or any kind of interest group, minority group, that I was seeing flourishing or was emerging into like, you know, dominant culture, I'd make it a point of principle to try and understand that a lot better. Because I feel like a lot of the time when people have opposition or discrimination, all that stuff stems from fear. If I have ever had an adverse feeling towards somebody, really doing the self-reflection and thinking, what is it about this person or their statement or what they're doing that you are not good with? So I think, you know, doing comedy and, you know, and just your normal social interactions have given me enough time and experience to not necessarily worry about what somebody says, but think about why they said it or who the person is saying it and looking at the context of that person. And, you know,
totally.
That's always kind of helped me a lot of time as well. It's like, for example, on, you know, transgender issues, I'm going to be honest with you. I personally feel like most men, when they talk about transgender women, what they mean is that like, I'm scared that I'm going to find myself attracted to a transgender woman and have to question my own sexuality. Yeah. There's a lot of air in the conversation about it, but the truth is, most monks, cisgender men, is like, I'm scared that I'm going to be attracted to a woman and then I'm going to be gay without being in control of it. That's what they really mean is a fear.
Me
personally, I'm just like, why should I be afraid of that? Maybe that's how I feel. Yeah. Why should I be afraid of my own natural and carnal inclinations?
I don't want to know something new about myself
I didn't realize before. Exactly. A lot of people base their own self-image on that kind of thing. That is like, well, this is who I've always been. And a lot of people choose these labels that they are afforded by society to like, you know, form a basis for their character. And that's not who my being is. So I guess when I'm thinking something, I'm always thinking from consciousness.
And I always think like one of the things which helped me the most in my life, the one piece of advice that helped me the most was when I first got, because I'm a recovering alcoholic and a recovering drug addict. And when I first got into recovery and was chatting to someone she became my AA sponsor. She was this sort of old Jewish woman who just at one point I was talking to her and after about 10 minutes, she interrupted me and she went, "You do know it's none of your business what other people think of you."
Exactly.
And as soon as I was able to sort of like internalize that and went, no, it isn't. Right. Okay. And that was a thing that was just like, oh, I don't have to take up all this mental energy worrying about what other people think of me because it's none of my fucking business.
Exactly. Because it's not something you can control. You have your own will and intent. Yeah. You can't control somebody else's. And it's funny because like that mantra, you know, it's like when people say only God can judge me. Right. And it's, but I'd say social media has been has ruined that ideal. Yeah. Human beings, I think, were able to rationalize and process their emotions and were a lot happy being freer and a lot freer knowing, not knowing what a collective consciousness thought about them.
Yeah, I tell you what, I've got a lot of people in my life who I really didn't need to know what the fuck they were eating. I had no need. It doesn't make me like you more. It doesn't make me like
you
more.
Trying to explain Twitter to anybody it's like, if you'd never seen it, like the best thing I can think of to try and explain that, all social media really, is it's that moment in a science fiction film, like in an episode of The Twilight Zone, or there's an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where somebody is suddenly able to hear what everyone else is thinking.
Yeah, exactly that.
Like, this is fucking amazing. And then very quickly, it drives them insane. And
absolutely.
That's what it does.
Well, think about this, Beth. If there is a God, and Sanjay, I hope you're listening to this. You know, people always say, why doesn't God answer our prayers? If a God could hear everything that human beings thought, would you fucking answer them? if an omnipotent, omniscient God and an omnipresent God can hear every inclination that most human beings have, and the same way that Twitter, you tweet what you're thinking or you do with your social media, if God had been privy to this from the start of creation, would you keep answering prayers? Like, if you think about just advertising towards cisgender heterosexual men, like the internet, 80% of the advertising is geared towards a big dick, which means there is a unified theory that is the biggest suggestion to most cishet men. So you imagine your God, you're listening to these same prayers. Before everyone goes to bed, can I have a bigger dick? Can I have a bigger dick? Can I have a bigger dick? Oh, 6 days for you not to ask me this.
If everyone does, then no one does.
Exactly, yeah. So for me, there is a real peace from doing that. And I'd say as well that by the same token, being able to take care of the people I care about. And just express it sometimes. Like before, sometimes when your family are going through stuff, a lot of time you can get very, I get very neurotic about, like, my mom, she's having ailing health or not being able to help my siblings and stuff like that. But I have learned, particularly with the lockdown, that, you know, my parents aren't just my parents. They are human beings and they are people with their own hopes, fears, dreams and inclinations themselves. And, you know, irrespective of how old somebody is, no one needs someone to be like, are you okay? You might die. Like, yeah, a big part of the peace I've experienced of more recent times has been able to have conversations with members of my family as people and not just, you know, as labels and as authoritarians and stuff. And, you know, understanding their humanity and their personage has given me a lot of peace. And I hope it's given them a lot of peace as well.
Yeah. Well, it's a good answer, Dane. It's a great question, man. That's an amazing question. And I'd love for listeners to just drop us a line on the social media about their ways to find peace. Maybe we'll find some help for all of us. But it's thank you for bringing that question. It's actually brought me a bit of peace actually discussing it in a unique way.
Sounds like someone's a bit high to me.
This podcast would not work if I got stoned. Just a quick note to all listeners: if I ever got baked and tried to do this, it would not work.
Here's a question from Mary Jane. How high is Howard?
I mean, the worst thing about it...
Will you ever not be high again? Maybe this is just you now. P.S. everybody knows.
Howard, just in bed. Wake up.
Oh, what a nice idea of a life that would be.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
thank you for that. No, it is an interesting time for people to look inwards. And my question carries on similar themes, actually, where I wanted to ask you guys, do you think that growing up with some challenging issues or elements to your person made you a better adult person? Because I often know, I'm not going to go specific with members of family or friends and stuff, but you kind of look around at certain kids that I know, and some of them are really fucking together. Like, maybe they were around when I was a kid and I was just hating them so much I couldn't notice them. But like, to be a really together young person, to me, is like, really? Like, you're not completely fucked up? Like, that was all I had as a kid. And I wanted to ask you guys if those things that troubled you as a kid made you better as an adult. Bethany, I don't know if you want to start us off.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, without wanting to sound arrogant about it, because this is a question that really lends itself to an arrogant answer of, yeah, I am a lot better. I am a fantastic adult as a result of this thing. But honestly, I think, rather than making me a better adult, it's made me a more empathetic adult. It's made me recognize that I'm not the only one who's gone through the things that I've gone through, and to look at the similarities that I have with other people rather than sort of try. Because I mean, it's difficult when you're in the middle of it, because I know that I really struggled with my mental health throughout my childhood and early adulthood. And once I started to work through that, and once I started to be able to sort of move beyond just lashing out and into starting to be able to ask people for help and starting to be able to work on stuff like that, it really enabled me to look at the stuff that I'd been through and then see how other people had been affected by that. Because it's that thing that, you know, that hurt people. That's kind of how stuff works. And to recognize that, especially when you, like, if you belong to any sort of marginalized community, you see what's going on, and you're like a canary in the coal mine. You spot the danger so much quicker than everyone else. And then people don't, but anybody who doesn't spot it just thinks you're overreacting. Mm-hmm. So what I feel like it's helped me to be able to do as I've got older and as I've become more confident in that is to be able to look to other people and just go, I believe you, and I believe you, and I'm not going to question like what you're saying, even if I don't necessarily understand it. I know where it's coming from, and I know enough to know that I should probably believe you, and then possibly, if it needs to be worked out later, why? Yeah. Do it then. Not immediately out of hand, just go, no, fuck off, I'm not having anything to do with you.
I'm sure you've been asked a lot of very repetitive questions about your journey. But
sure.
What age did you feel, because that's the one thing that always comes to me, is I think it's a really interesting element of it all, which is what age did you feel, oh God, this is,
from a very, very young, I realised that there was something that didn't quite add up. And I must have been about 3 or 4 years old watching a TV show. It was an episode of The Love Boat where Gopher, who was like the steward on The Love Boat, met up with someone who he thought was the sister of someone who he went to university with. And it turned out it wasn't. It was the person. And that was like the first time I ever saw anyone trans mentioned anywhere in any media, and it just like in my head went, right, so is that a thing? Because this is fiction, so it might just be a thing that they've made up for the sake of this, but if that is a thing, then that would explain a lot about how I feel about myself. And then over the sort of the next 10 to 15 years, it was a gradual case of slowly recognizing that, but also seeing how the rest of society sort of reacted to the idea of trans people existing at all. And it was always fear, hatred, or something to be laughed at, or something exotic. Those were all of the things. And so I knew that I shouldn't tell anybody that I cared about, because again, all of the narratives around it were that if I told anybody that I cared about that I was trans, that they would immediately disown me.
Well, and representation in media of trans, I mean, just to be completely blunt, is so fucked up when you look back at...
Oh, God, yeah.
I've often brought up the Ace Ventura.
Yeah, yeah.
which is absolutely like, I mean, obviously Ace Ventura, the character, and in terms of Jim Carrey, the actor, funny fucking stuff, right? But the plot, the main plot of that film is incredibly offensive.
Yeah, it's horrific. And representation for such a long time just was non-existent. And wherever it was existent, like, it was always, like, in fiction, it was always that sort of story. Like, you know how fucked up it is that if a sitcom mentions Thailand at some point, it's got to the point where if a TV show says anyone on a TV show scripted says the word Thailand, my heart rate increases slightly and I get a slight jolt of adrenaline because I'm like, all right, okay, this is about to get transphobic. From the sort of late 90s to sort of up until like 2008, 2009 when Twitter came along, being out and being trans and having transitioned, I was part of various different like message boards and groups, and they were always very insular and they always tried to protect the group, the people who were on there, from anyone from outside. And then social media came along and Twitter came along, and suddenly it was a large enough platform worldwide that enough trans people could talk to each other and talk to each other about our experiences without it being behind sort of like closed doors. Mm-hmm. And so that a lot of cisgender people could also see what we were saying to each other and how we talked to each other and how we were experiencing our lives. And so as a result of that, that's kind of how it's been a fantastic progression for so many people. It's been a way of, it's been great for the community in that respect, because it's allowed a lot more people to go, oh, I'm not alone. And a lot of people who perhaps were trans and would have continued trying to hide it have been less inclined to try and do that. It's enabled people to come out and people to be more comfortable with who they are, and more people to be more comfortable with their gender expression and how they and to go, actually, do you know what, I've never, you know, a lot more non-binary people who have now gone, do you know, I had no idea, I'd always felt like this, but I had no idea that that was a thing. And are then able to do that, then able to sort of express that and put it into words. And I think that's a thing that's it's allowed us to have our own narrative. It's allowed us to take control of our own narrative. And as soon as that's happened, obviously there's backlash because people get incredibly scared.
Whatever it is, it gets backlash. Don't worry about that. Everything gets hit, but it's amazing.
It's going back to what we were saying before, Howard, is that for a lot of people, in terms of peace, is that a lot of people's self-esteem is very much rooted in them having a privileged or superior position within society. So when they realize, particularly within a capitalist society, that they have to compete for resources and opportunities like everybody else, it's really not so much about the nuance of a particular marginalized group. It's just equal competing, which people find very difficult, especially where Darwinist theory is so like survival of the fittest. And so, you know, this idea about survival and stuff, I think people find very daunting, and it kind of brings out the worst in us.
There's a really interesting Harvard study that was done, a psychological study, where they asked groups of people, and they did it within Harvard and they did it outside of, you know, to make sure that, like they do with a lot of these things, where they replicated it, to just ask people whether they would prefer to live in a world where everybody got $250,000 a year and they got $200,000 a year, but everything that was around was the same price as it is now. Nothing had increased in price. So comparatively, they'd be a lot richer than they are, but they'd be slightly less rich than everybody else. Or if they would prefer to have more money, but be poorer than they are now and have everyone else slightly poorer than them. And 50% of people, every time it was replicated, went for they would rather be poorer but richer than everybody else. And it kind of ties into the idea of, you know, why the super rich become super rich when they have money that they can't possibly spend. Yeah. And they want to get more and more and more. It's because it's not to them, it's not about having enough. It's about having more than everybody else.
Mm. Yeah. And then being on the wheel in that cycle of needing to do it all the time. I mean...
It's not just money. It goes into everything else. It's like resources. Yeah. It's lives. They've got a better house than I have. I want to have more than that. It's what goes and feeds the conflict between us.
Absolutely. As soon as human beings were able to see themselves in mirrors, when it's all the shit kicked off. But I'd say, your answer is almost identical to mine, Bethany, in that I think my experiences, the more adverse ones I've had in my youth, have allowed me to be a lot more empathetic. But at the same time, I've always been someone I'd like to think has had a thirst for knowledge, and I've always kind of sought enlightenment whenever I could. And there has been some very pivotal points in my life where people have questioned my quest for enlightenment, and that's always been real beneficial. So I'd say, do you know what, in reflection as a child, I don't think there's anyone I went to school with directly who's reassigned changed their gender over time. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really name it, have direct contact with people that are trans, but the people that have come out maybe as homosexual since I've been to school and stuff, none of it's been particularly surprising. It's probably been, there's been patterns of behavior stuff I've been able to pick up on. And it's kind of like, well, I could see that, you know, years ago. And, you know, where some people weren't able to articulate or, you know, some people behave in a very adverse way because of fear to something they're not used to seeing. For me, I was always just very curious about everything anyway. And, you know, I suppose I grew up in a household where it wasn't particularly restrictive, but my parents did adhere to a lot of traditional tenets, like children are seen and not heard. You must carry yourself a certain way in the home. Mm-hmm. So any opportunity to be outside was just like a anthropological study for me, where it's like I get to see so many different people from, you know, different worlds and cultures. And so I would always kind of take it in and just kind of gorge on that opportunity. But I would say, Howard, you know, and it's Bethany as well, I think that 50-50 is correct, because on the one hand, Howard, like hurt people, but I also feel like people say the soul is forged in suffering. So your ability to empathize and connect with other human beings is normally based on you being able to understand, you know, the gravity of a tragedy or a trauma someone's experienced and be able to have a kind of commonality of that. That's normally how most human beings kind of rapport build. Or I guess on the other hand, it's like it's projection as well, where sometimes people try and recreate the same kind of environments and paradigms where they may have suffered their trauma in order for them to have control over the same thing and kind of process it. So, you know, it manifests in a number of different ways. So, you know, on the one hand, you do get people who are all made all the better for their experiences, and they can, you know, you have a Martin Luther King who will go and try and bring peace and harmony to the entire world. On the other hand, you have like a Milo Yiannopoulos, where it's kind of like you have that kind of Stockholm syndrome, where it's almost as if like you try to replicate your oppressors in order to have control over the kind of narrative and stuff, which, you know, is, for me, I always find is a very destructive way of being, because if you are someone that's experienced trauma and then you inflict that same kind of trauma on someone else that you perceive to be equally vulnerable, what you're doing is, I believe philosophically, is you are validating the trauma that you suffered, because you can doesn't mean you should. And as I call it to my friends, like, you have to go back and kill the monsters under your bed, because by you first of all have to acknowledge you were maybe the victim of trauma, and also acknowledge the fact that you weren't deserving of that trauma, even though you have experienced it, whether it's in your home or not. And then it's a question of, like, you know, working towards extinguishing that within yourself rather than allowing that to replicate on other people, because what you don't want to do is validate this. And I feel like that's something I endeavor myself as well, is that, like, I don't try and do to people what has been done to me, because by me doing that, it means it was okay for it to be done to me in the first place.
Yeah. I think it's that thing when you look at people like Milo, and you look at some of the other people that, cause it's always that thing of, like, if you want to try and figure out whether or not your side are the baddies, have a look at whether or not you can provide. Have a look at whether or not, whenever anyone calls you out on it, whether you just immediately go, how can I possibly be? Because I have some non-representative members of that marginalized group who are on my side. Because what happens when you're in a marginalized group and you receive that trauma, you're in that trauma, it's quite a well-known sort of psychological thing that happens, where people, a number of them, will go and try and sell out everyone else in order for proximity to power, just because that's which makes them feel comfortable. Because it's like, right, I can't change the world, but what I can do is try and be friends with the bully so that they will ignore me. I'm not like them.
Remember, if they're facing this way, they're not looking at me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for me, it's a very simple principle. And it's like, and just to elaborate when you say, Howard, I believe that, like, our formative years are from 0 to 7. And it's not like we're not capable of maturity, but I think most of the coping strategies and our reactions to stimulus and situations doesn't tend to change that much from when you're a child. Because myself, I always feel like, you know, I can always revisit my inner child or my younger self, or reflect on experiences from my childhood. And I can be like, I would have probably done the same thing if I could now. I mean, the main difference normally is that maybe I wasn't able to articulate, or I didn't have the experience to react to something a lot of the time. But for me, mainly, like, I would have dealt with things in the same way. And I think, like, sometimes a childlike approach to certain situations tends to be the best way, only because of the fact that, like, children are normally most preoccupied with their own self-gratification and happiness, like most people. It's only when they have to become a functioning member of a society that they have to temper their feelings and emotions in order for them to conform or fit within a circle. But I think, you know, if you can go back to being very childlike and be like, does this make me happy? Or does this make me feel safe? Does this make me feel vulnerable? If the answer is yes, then it's probably not a good situation for me to be in. I think a lot of the time we are aware of these kind of esoteric truths, and then we kind of layer it on with like, but I've got to pay my salary, I've got to have a pension, I've got to support my family, and blah, blah. And we've created all of these new labels and ideas and all of these kind of new aspects of social etiquette, which aren't actually that beneficial to us, but it's how we think we should be. And I've always, like, especially over the last 10 years where I've been, you know, doing comedy, I've definitely tried to move away from that, and I find it to be beneficial. But I really feel like it can go one of two ways. But I think most people who do acknowledge and process their trauma efficiently, and, you know, most human beings, because we're not actually predisposed to conflict anyway, I think sometimes having traumatic experiences at least can give you a sense of mutuality or commonality with other people. And so it's kind of like, you know, hurt people, but at the same time, I feel like the soul is forged in suffering. And it's like, you know, if someone's been through something, they obviously will have a certain level of humility to them. Like, there's a reason why the etymology of humility and humanity are very similar. So there's an element.
I hope that our listeners have enjoyed those answers as much as I have, because I think we could just talk about that one for the rest of the day. It's kind of, it's fascinating, isn't it? You're looking back on your childhood, I think. I often think it's cursed me a little bit, as in, like, I'm trying to rewire myself, you know, kind of.
But there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. Like, it's your brain, it's an organ of that level of complexity. Why not rewire it?
I just sometimes wish I hadn't. I would just sometimes wish I hadn't had it from the start. you know what I mean? To be like, I know, I wish I'd known that, because I keep falling into these old traps, you know, you can have, but it's such a fascinating thing, you know. No, I don't, you know, I'm not going to say exactly who I'm talking about, but I've got this one person I know whose childhood seems to genuinely be full of nothing but happiness, and I'm just looking at him thinking, God, something's going to go horribly wrong in your adult life.
don't do that, because that could happen, but you don't necessarily wish for that, because
I'm not wishing for it at all. It's actually just more fear for this person, because it's just like everything's so good in their adult life. I'm just like, fucking hell.
How will you cope with it? It's like I had like the worst sort of 3 years of my life about 8 years ago. I got dumped just before I was supposed to get married. Then I got a long-term illness, which then developed into chronic fatigue syndrome. Then I went and broke my leg really badly, and then had a bad reaction to it. And over the course of like 2 years, I had six really close friends die in a really short space of time, and just every single day something horrific was happening. And then it was at the end of it when I broke my leg, and then I had the reaction to the metal, and I couldn't walk for 18 months. And all the way through it, people were just like, how are you coping with this? And one of the ways that I helped myself to be able to get through that was to be able to go, at least it's happening to me, rather than I could name half a dozen of my friends who I honestly don't think would be able to survive this, and I know that I can. So by comparison, that is pretty much the only place I can sort of be mentally to process.
God is love, and you love your friends, so you are happy to make that sacrifice and be a martyr for their happiness. Mm. So again, I totally get that notion.
It's probably time for your question, Dane, which I know you've got, and great to hear what you want to ask.
Well, I'm going to keep it very overt and almost quite obvious. And so in a nutshell, Bethany, obviously, the starring in Banana, Cucumber and Tofu was a great look, and I hope you enjoyed the experience.
That's wonderful.
As I said, you're doing amazing work so far, I mean, obviously in the creative industry, as well as your interest in popular culture, like comic books and the like. You know, you mentioned before that, like, all of the earlier representations of the trans community were negative, which I'm also aware of. But I do remember an anime and a manga called Ram the Half.
Right, I haven't seen that. So
he's a martial artist that took a bath in hot springs, but if he's in hot and cold water, his gender changes accordingly.
Ah, cool.
And I remember, like, reading that comic in brief, but it was a phenomenon that everybody was comfortable with.
Yeah.
And for me, I was kind of like, well, people seem to be fine with that. And I also had, you know, quite an avid interest in mythology when I was younger and stuff as well, probably because of comic books, I imagine, where, again, the change, you know, changing of gender and a reassignment of gender was not a crazy concept. And then, and this is not me being like a long way saying, I've got transgender friends and blah, blah, blah. It allows for that aesthetic to be normalized in my mind anyway. And I guess what I want to ask overall is that, like, you know, given obviously you have a keen amount of avid interest and have actively been involved in being a trailblazer for the trans community, I would like to ask you, maybe over the, say, a timescale of like over the last 5 years, where would you say you've seen the most positive portrayals of the trans community? Or is there a, in a very short space of time, how would you say the journey has been over the last 5 years? And I know you can't be a spokesperson for the entire community, but me and Howard are otherwise completely unenlightened. So I was wondering, is everything good? How are you guys doing? So by the same token, you can extend this question to the trans community. I'm asking as another person, how are you guys doing? How are you feeling about
this? Do you know what? I think like over the last 5 or 6 years, it's been a really interesting journey because it's been the fastest that I've seen the progress for the trans community. But also at the same time, there's been so much more pushback. The pushback has become so much more pronounced. The quality of representations has got so much better. They've started getting more and more trans people in, not just for sort of sensitivity readers for scripts, but there are more trans people in every level of the industry within television and so on. And also in so many other industries, in film and in tech and like just so many more places. There are so many more trans
people. The Wachowski twins?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Siblings.
Yeah. The Wachowskis, but like, it's interesting that you should like to talk about mythology and the things that you're interested in, because yeah, for the whole history of humanity up until like the 19th century, there was a lot less, of an idea of such strict and rigid gender roles. And trans people have been around for as long as people have been around.
Absolutely.
And our stories have been out there. And what happened was throughout sort of like the 18th, 19th and early 20th century, historians and people who were involved in those things did the same thing that they do when they do anything else. So they just go, let's go and put this through our lens.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like in the Iliad, the fact that Achilles, his friend, I think is how it's how a lot of the 19th century translations of it have it, dies, and he asks that when he dies, can he have their ashes mixed together so that they can be together for all eternity? And people go, yes, so they were friends. Clearly they were just friends.
Like the Spartans, like in the 300 when the Spartans, and I'm like, for a soldier, he's taking that guy's death real hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Real hard.
You know, and there are so many things like that, like LGBT representations throughout history where they've just gone, oh, no, it's just, two friends who did that. This woman who went and hid in the bed of her boss, of the lady of the manor that she worked for every night for 15 years as a joke.
King James, who was with Buckingham Palace, is named after his lover, Lord Buckingham, they say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Killed his wife, innit? Because he was like, I want to be with my your lover.
Yeah, and so many of these things that like were happening, and then it was as it became codified and as it became that sort of age of the Victorian era, as they went through that sort of thing, it like so much of it was either erased out of history or it was like, no, this is how things are and we don't really talk about that. And so what's been interesting over the last sort of 5 or 6 years in terms of how the trans community is trans representations in media have gone is that it's just meant that we've been able to undo some of that. But then, you know, on the other side of that, there's the same 10,000 people on Twitter who are absolutely furious about anything to do with trans people existing, who every Sunday will go on and say something transphobic just to try and get as many trans people to be upset by it so that they can then dogpile them until they say something horrific, screen cap it, and then go, see what these people are like? That happens so pretty much every week. That's happened for the last 5 years or so. And it's that same sort of cult behavior that you get in certain religious sects where they go, right, go out and try and convert people. It's not because they want to convert people, because they know it won't convert people. It's because they know that if you go and send somebody out from your little church to go, would you like to join our church? And people go, no, fuck off. When they get back to the church and everyone's lovely, it's like, yeah, they're horrible outside, but you're lovely in here. It's a way of building bonds with people. It's how you keep people. It's like, yeah, it's a like really old school brainwashing technique. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to focus on that. But one of the things that I've tried to do over the last like 5 or so years is I completely got out of all of those arguments. I'm not arguing my humanity with anyone. I don't have to because I've tried it and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. the worst thing you can do is engage on their terms. So instead, I just try and live my life as happily and as positive as I can do. And it's great to see that there are more representations coming through. I still personally, because of having grown up with that and having grown up with such horrific negative representations of trans people as I was growing up, and it nearly, because I had a nervous breakdown before I came out, I'd reached the point where I thought that my two choices were to kill myself or to lose everybody that I'd ever cared about. And if I killed myself, then at least they would think that it would save them the embarrassment and the horror of having to cope with me living my life as who I am.
And it's that sense of selflessness, yeah, that it seems to be the plight of so many people that want to come out and stuff like that as well. Because I had a friend, and like, just going back to you saying before, Howard, about like, you know, being able to be the same, like go through experiences and be able for those to filter into your empathy. I had a friend who I went to school with years ago, saw him recently, and he said he came out, and I was like, oh, why don't you tell me, man? It would have been cool. And he was like, Dane, remember how we grew up? Like, it wouldn't have been cool. Yeah. I'm like, I would have understood. But he's like, yeah, maybe you would have understood, but you knew the kind of environment we lived in. And when he said that, I was like, all right, I do understand. But like, for the most part, that's the same rationale that a lot of people have. It's like, my shame won't be a burden to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so as a result of that, the aftermath of that is that I still find it quite difficult to watch things where I know that there's going to be trans characters in it. I find it difficult to engage with my own community on that level, because for me in certain things, it still feels like danger to me.
Mm-hmm. Because it's been done so badly in the past, right?
Because it's been done so badly. Yeah. And because it seemed to only ever have like three storylines. It was the hot trans woman that no one realized was trans and had therefore tricked a straight guy into sleeping with her. Mm. Or it was what was quite clearly a cisgender guy in a dress who was predatory. Those are like the two tropes that you would have. And to see that repeated so often, and to see that things that you enjoy and things that you're watching hate you.
Mate, preaching to the choir.
Fucking despise you and do not want you to exist.
I mean, that's the part of people that understand about inclusion or representation, is the fact that like, you don't understand what it does for someone's psychology just to see someone on a billboard that looks like you smiling.
Yeah,
like, people don't understand like the importance of that if you've not experienced that. And because that's the privilege of normalcy, or the normalcy, or the normalcy of aesthetic. A lot of people don't understand that. Like you said, if people... Yeah. Watching TV and all media suggests that you are a figure of hatred. People understand what that would do to somebody's comforts.
And so for me, the best trans representation I think I've ever seen on any TV show or anything that I've watched is the character of Taylor in Billions, who is a non-binary character played by a non-binary actor. And I got to that part in the second series and was so nervous watching that. Like, I had dry mouth watching the episode.
Wow.
As Taylor walks in and talks to Bobby Axelrod, which, of course, I love the show, but like, Bobby Axelrod, that is definitely a placeholder name. He's a billionaire. We'll call him Bobby Axelrod. We'll call him something better later. Like, might as well have just called him Rich White Man. You know what I mean? it's like, you know, in the movie Taken, when like the teenage, there's a clear placeholder in that, because the teenage girls, it's like they've gone, oh, they're going to go off and follow a band around Europe. What band? We'll say U2 for now, but we'll find out what band girls like.
What are the kids like nowadays? Oh, they love that Bono.
Yeah, and they haven't. So in the film, it's that they're going to watch U2. But yeah, and so when the character, when they walked in, they walk into Bobby Axelrod, and it's such like a macho environment in that TV series in Billions. And they walk into Bobby Axelrod's office and they say, my name's Taylor and my pronouns are they and them. And Bobby Axelrod goes, great. And that was it. That was literally, and then to see someone who is non-binary, who is trans, who is existing in this, like what you would consider to be quite macho environment, but being treated with respect by the sort of people who call themselves alpha males was just, for me, that was like, as far as I was concerned, that is like one of the best representations that I've seen. And it spoke to me particularly about being able to get over that particular hurdle because I recognise myself in that within the comedy industry.
A sub question on the concept of comedy. Has there been any instance where I've been flippantly transphobic or ignorant of you as a person?
No, not at all. No. Honestly, in my experience as a comic, one of the things that I found out that's really quite funny is I had no idea that there are lots of comedians on the UK circuit doing jokes about trans issues because none of them have ever dared to do it when I've been on the bill.
Oh, really? Okay.
Except for, there's only one person who's ever like had the fucking guts to like go, actually, do you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to do this bit and I don't care. And that was Adam Rowe. And I just heard the start of it and went, all right, okay. And then didn't listen to the rest of it because I was backstage and something else was going on. I went, all right, okay, fair enough. But yeah, mostly, like, I had absolutely no, like, the amount of people who've gone, oh, so what do you think of all of these cis male comics who've got all of these opinions on trans issues? And I was like, I've not heard any of them, really.
This has been will you come back on the show? We need to do this again, right, Dane? Because it's been superb.
Absolutely. I think we've got one of our guests locked in for the next live show. Always a pleasure to see you and break.
I would love to. Thank you so much, Dane. It's always a pleasure.
I'm really grateful for this, and it's something I definitely want to continue as a conversation in general. Not just on the podcast, but in general. But for anyone who wants to find out more about your work and more about the topics we've discussed, where can they find your stuff, please?
I'm on Twitter, and I do a lunchtime chat show.
Lovely. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a real joy, and so sorry, listeners. I'm sure you were wanting us to keep going on that last question because I think there's about another 20 different layers. I mean, the only thing I can add to it, what I was thinking, is that isn't it exciting to think where representation is going to go in this next decade on screen? Like, it seems like what you're saying, the surface has only just been scratched, really, right, Bethany?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think what's exciting is that now people are more excited about asking about these stories. I mean, I've been working with various different TV channels and production companies to try and get stuff made. And I can definitely feel that there's a change in the way that they're going about things. Because 6 years ago when I'd first been on TV and they were like, we want to make something with you. It felt like they wanted to want to make something with me. But they didn't actually want to make something with me. They wanted to be able to sort of say, oh, well, we tried to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Say they developed it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas now it's a lot of people going, we really do want to make this. Can we get this made? How do we get this made? How do we get onto this? And it's interesting to see that because we're now reaching a point where our stories are starting to be told by us, about us, and through our lens rather than what we mean to cisgender people.
Well, that's so exciting.
I love that. We love to see it, love to hear it. Bethany, thank you so much for coming up on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
We should catch up very, very soon, and I'll get your feedback regarding The Falcon and the Winter Soldier once the series is done.
Oh, definitely.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Bethany Black. You can follow her on Twitter at Bethany Black or Instagram at BethanyBlack1978. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQEPodcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.